Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. You've probably encountered at least one of these multi-level marketers while scrolling through Facebook. Writer James Fell put out a call to find out more about the consumer experience as it relates to multi-level marketing, and he pulled it all together in a piece called The 13 Multi-Level Marketers You'll Meet in Hell. You want to retire early? Maybe the FIRE movement is right for you. It takes discipline and patience, but it can work. Mr. Prairie Fire is the pen name for a guy in Saskatchewan who has hit financial independence. He'll be here to tell us more about this movement and about his own personal experience. Then, calling all first-time credit card users. Choosing the right card is only the first step. Knowing the best way to use it, it's a whole new challenge. RateHub's co-founder and CEO, Alyssa Furtado, is here to tell us more about some credit card do's and don'ts for students. And managing a credit card and a budget is especially hard for those on an irregular income. Credit Canada's Lori Campbell will be here to talk about budgeting through the hills and valleys. Plus, what you might not know about saving for your child's post-secondary education. RESPs help families save, but there are some additional options out there for families with a lower income. The executive director of Smart Saver will be here. His name's Luke Connell. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Skincare, cosmetics, candles, supplements, telecom services, kitchen gadgets, jewelry. You name the category, and there is likely a multi-level marketing company trying to sign you up to go out and sell for them. Sometimes straining your relationships in the process. I've always been sort of intrigued and repelled by the business model in equal measure, but you can't argue that it has staying power. James Fell is a writer and lifestyle consultant. He recently wrote a piece called The 13 Multi-Level Marketers You'll Meet in Hell. He joins us now from Calgary, Alberta. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, how are you?
You are a writer best known for writing about fitness. Why did you decide to write about multi-level marketing?
Well, fitness and health and nutrition and weight loss are all things where MLMs make their presence known to a significant degree, whether it's weight loss shakes or, you know, essential oils that are going to cure cancer or something like that, or, you know, those the saran wrap that you put around your stomach to make you...
Wait, are you saying that doesn't work? What?
The name of the company is It Works, but I'm pretty sure
pretty sure that it doesn't. Now, you put out a call for stories on this topic and got a lot of replies. What was the ratio of good to bad?
There wasn't any good.
No good. Okay. Well, I mean, it was self-selecting. People, you were asking for people's consumer stories, so maybe that accounts for something. But you got a lot of responses.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, there was about 700 or 800 comments, and I think it was close to 100 private messages that people sent me because they didn't want their families to see their comments because it was their family members that they were talking about. There were a few people that snuck in there saying, hey, don't paint all MLMs as bad because this one that I happen to sell is wonderful, blah, blah, blah.
And they were just, and while we're on the topic,
they never stopped selling.
Can you host a party? Now, of course, this is a personal finance show, but we're going to get into your 13 examples in a second. But what would you say overall that you learned about how people make money or don't make money in the world of MLM?
You know, it's pretty interesting that people get into this, they get sucked into it, and I genuinely do feel bad for them because it's a predatory business model where only the top 1% make any real money at it. That if you are morally bankrupt and want to start an MLM company, you can and really clean up by taking advantage of other people. And really, it's not that you're going to end up selling a whole bunch of products to a wide base of people. It's the people that you end up recruiting are the ones that end up with buying a whole bunch of your products, and quite often that they can't even sell it. And it's quite interesting that I just got an email today from something called Magnify Money that had done a study on MLMs and said that your average person that participates in a multi-level marketing program earns less than 70 cents an hour.
Wow. Well, that's not quite minimum wage, regardless of where you live in the world, probably, but certainly not anywhere in Canada. You wrote about these 13 multi-level marketers that you meet in hell. Give us an overview of what you're going for, and then I'm going to ask you about some of the specific ones that intrigue me.
So one of the things about the ways that these MLMs work is it's another term for it is network marketing. So you're supposed to use your network to recruit other people underneath you, and then you each get a percentage of you get a percentage of what they sell, and they recruit other people who get a percentage, who gets a percentage, and so on and so forth. But really, it's only the people at the very top that end up making money. But it puts out this this mindset of, well, you have to start recruiting people, and so you recruit those people who you know. And the first one on the list was the in quotations, the friend.
Right.
So the person that you knew in high school and haven't talked to in 20 years, all of a sudden sends you a friend request on Facebook. And within 5 minutes, they're like, hey, girl, it's me, the girl who either totally ignored you or low-key bullied you in high school,
right.
Hun. Anyway, hun, I'm a successful mompreneur living a blessed life and a boss babe. And, you know, this hashtag crazy where they're trying to rope you into, you know, selling jewelry or makeup or essential oils or something like that. And they say, oh, it's not a pyramid scheme. But when they say it's not a pyramid scheme, yeah, it kind of totally is.
The ambulance chaser sounds a little more, I don't know, disconcerting, that people would prey on someone's vulnerabilities. It's one thing to just, you know, make a friendship that wasn't there seem more real decades later. But an ambulance chaser?
That one, I noticed were the ones that people were the most angry about. And to explain it to the listeners, it's the person who, if someone makes a public comment about an illness, or, you know, they talk about their child's autism or their mother's breast cancer or anything like that, they will jump in offering to sell them this product as some type of miracle cure. Now, there is no cure. It doesn't work. So first of all, they're spewing some BS, and they're taking advantage of this person's situation or predicament or dealing with a very upsetting emotional experience to say, have you tried Juice Plus? Mm. And that one's pretty despicable. And it really shows the depth to which these companies can make people sink. That, again, like it's kind of hard for me to really hate the people that do stuff like this, because I feel like they're also victims too of this predatory business that preyed on their desperation for money in the first place.
The one that I have seen on your list, the one that I've seen the most, is you call it the incessant I love my life social media maven. And this is in my feed. Like, I love that you're so happy. And then why are all those products there? And why do you keep posting about those? That seems like a pretty common strategy.
Yeah, I've definitely seen those ones. And I don't mind them that much, because they're advertising, but they're not quite so pushy, where they're not coming into your direct messages and leaving comments everywhere, and they're not quite so predatory. So I said that they were one of the least annoying, because if that's all they do, well, then you can just click unfollow.
Right. Which I have. Why do you think so many health products are sold through multi-level marketing? Why is it so prevalent?
I think that health products are one of those things where pseudoscience and scamming is very susceptible. I mean, modern medicine is the best we've got, but it's far from perfect. I'm married to a family physician, and I know that when you look at cancer, for example, that we've gotten a lot better in our treatments of it and our cure rates, but it's still far from perfect. The treatments are not fun at all. There's still lots of people die from cancer each year, and people want some type of miracle cure. This is why, you know, alternative medicine has become so popular, that people want something that sounds all natural, and there's no side effects, and it's a guaranteed cure, and blah blah blah. So if people are willing to believe that pseudoscientific aspect of health and fitness, then they're also willing to believe the miraculous money-making abilities, you know, heavy on the sarcasm there, participating in this MLM.
Now, if I had someone senior here in any of those organizations, what they would probably say is, listen, this is an opportunity for work-life balance that doesn't exist in our economy today, in particular for women. I don't know what the gender skew is statistically, but I would assert that it skews female, and working moms and people trying to make it all come together with all these incessant pressures on our life. Do you have some compassion for people who are drawn to that kind of a promise?
Oh, I absolutely do. But to them, I would say the data doesn't prove it out that it works. That if you actually do just a little bit of digging, you will find that people are genuinely not making money at this, and they're alienating their friends and family in the process. And sometimes people are actually actively losing money, because one of the tactics of these MLMs is, in order to stay at a certain percentage level or a certain ranking, they all do it, you know, a little bit differently to accomplish the same thing, you have to purchase a certain amount of product each month, and then you turn around and you sell it either directly or out to your network. And a lot of these people get stuck with garages full of this stuff, where they actually lost money rather than making money.
Right. You can only consume so many protein shakes.
Yeah, exactly. And you're stuck with this product that you can't sell. And so then what are you going to do? I definitely appreciate people wanting to have a greater work-life balance and looking for ways to work from home or, do something that allows them to make a bit of money on the side. But unfortunately, you know, this is one of those situations where if it sounds too good to be true, it is. You need to look elsewhere at something that does have a proven track record of success. And I don't necessarily know what that's going to be. There's got to be lots of different opportunities out there that you can find that are specific to your own education, skill set, capabilities, whatever, where you can make some money in a genuine manner that takes advantage of, you know, proven capitalistic practices, for lack of a better term. Whereas this is, it's just so predatory, where the people at the very top clean up and the ones underneath them are the ones that are being taken advantage of.
James, appreciate you bringing your perspective on this.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on the show.
James Fell is a writer. He recently wrote a piece called The 13 Multi-Level Marketers You Will Meet in Hell.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many, many people dream about retiring early, but turning that dream into reality can kind of feel out of reach. There is a relatively new approach called FIRE, Financial Independence Retire Early. It's a loosely connected community of people who share this goal and are working hard to bring it to reality. Fred Conje, also known as Mr. Prairie Fire, is here to talk to us about his own path towards financial independence. He joins us now from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me.
There has been a lot of mainstream press about the FIRE movement in the last, call it, year or so, but you have been working on this for longer than that. How did you hear about it in the beginning, the FIRE movement?
I think the FIRE movement has been around for quite a while. For myself, I'm still a little bit of a rookie. It's been about 2 years. And the way I discovered it is I went through my own, what I call, three financial shocks of living an average life, a family of two, dream home, great job, but then hit some financial troubles, and I did my own research and discovered FIRE just by Googling financial independence.
What does it mean for you? How do you define what it actually is, and how does that affect your behavior in the present moment?
I think the main crux of the financial independence, retire early movement is about control and about freedom. I sort of see it as three elements: the education, awareness, and then having a plan to implement it, which I find the FIRE community provides as a great resource that way. And so the ability to get enough savings to put into investments or any other assets that you think that could help you reach independence at a certain level, For the traditional FIRE movement, it's about 25 times your annual income.
Where are you at? Where are you in terms of the gestation of this? Are you firing? Are you fired?
Oh, I'm still really at the beginning, learning a lot. I would say I'm probably at the stage where I have a clear plan. I have a buy-in by my family, and we're trying to increase our savings rate. We're currently at about 25%, and we're shooting for 35% savings every month.
And what will it take for you to get there? I mean, some people in some adherents talk about a 70% savings rate, which I cannot even fathom. But how will you increase it by a full 10 points?
I think for us, we're at a little bit of an advantage where we're at the early stages of our family. And so my wife is working at home and not really taking in any income. But when our kids are old enough, they're ready to go to school, and my wife will have some more time to invest in getting a full-time job. And that'll really increase our savings rate significantly. One of the key principles is being able to live off of one income and then taking the second income and putting it towards savings for early retirement.
One of the other elements on the future front is this nest egg that spins off income in some form. So maybe that's rental properties, maybe that's dividend stocks. When you look ahead to what your portfolio will look like in order to provide you with an income, how are you going to approach that?
I think for us, we try to keep it as simple as possible just in regards to what we want to invest in. So we look at particular what's called index funds. Or ETFs, so they're usually a common term. And using those in a proper balanced portfolio, for us, we're about 80% stocks and 20% bonds. And we're going to shift that as we get older to be able to more stability. But our portfolio is just putting in that money to as soon as possible, as fast as possible, to take advantage of compounding interest.
How did your friends and family react outside of your, you know, immediate with your spouse? But how did your friends and family react? They think you're like a loop-de-loo?
I get a lot of raised eyebrows and side glances to be like, first of all, what exactly are you talking about? Especially when we talk about our goal to retire like by the time I'm 45. And so it's a bit of a challenge, right, to be able to counter the normal way of doing things and putting on sort of the hat of being able to sell it. And so when I speak about it, people are interested and intrigued. They always want to know more, and that sort of actually spurned my website, Prairie Fire Canada, to sort of educate folks, because I've got a lot of people wanting to know, but I didn't have time to tell them. So I'm like, I'll just throw it on a blog and see what happens.
What has been the hardest part? What's been the biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge is sort of going against the grain and fighting those larger forces that encourage you to sort of get off the path, right? Be it commercials or people who are wanting to, you surround yourself with, who are always wanting to go for dinner, and just being disciplined, right? We know what to do. It's just the hard part is implementing it and being focused.
There are so many blogs like yours, people telling their stories. And I had recently described the community as skewing male and skewing towards people who worked in technology. One of my listeners corrected me on that front. She was not amused by that characterization. But tell me about how that community works. Do you find that you reach out to other people? Do you have physical meetups of people in Saskatchewan who are already pursuing this? How does that work?
I think the popularity of FIRE has sort of just started and becoming mainstream. One of the challenges that we face is that we are separated by distance, especially in Canada. And so I haven't had any physical meetups, but I'm encountering people in Vancouver, Manitoba, Winnipeg specifically. And there's a large collection in more dense areas, for example, Toronto and Quebec. And one of the things I'm finding is that using the internet as sort of a launching pad to discover what FIRE is, but there's a huge community online, be it on Facebook or Twitter, that's having this conversation, and you can ask any question. I asked a bunch of dumb questions and got some great answers and resources and support, and the one thing I get the most benefit out of the community is that I'm not alone. And that's one challenge for people today, is that when I look at the stats, about 50% of people take on their financial challenges on their own, trying to figure it out.
One of the big questions that some people would have, aside from, geez, how could I ever reduce my consumption, is what would I do if I wasn't working? Not just practically in terms of like, how do I spend my days, but also where one's sense of identity will come from if you're not working in the traditional world. How do you address that question?
For me, I think that's a really important question in regards to the value of work and how people, you know, tie their identity there. For myself, I'm a big supporter of volunteering in the community. I've always done it. I actually come from the nonprofit sector. And so I still see myself being engaged and trying to make a difference in the community. But there's not saying that I wouldn't work after I reach that sort of financial independent stage. I think it's really about freedom. And what do you do when you have that freedom? So many people are caught up in the day-to-day. They haven't really taken time to do it. And by me going through the process of understanding FIRE and identifying my goals, it's allowed me to think beyond just the day, the month, the year, and just like, what do I really want to do with my life?
Just 30 seconds left. What is one piece of advice would you have for people who might be considering pursuing the FIRE approach?
I think for them is really taking a good understanding of their spending. It's good to go into your budget and find out where money is going. But I think looking at the larger goals in your life and making sure it aligns with who you are and your values, that has helped me significantly to determine where I want money to go, but also my goals in the future.
Really interesting. Fred, hopefully we can chat again down the line and see how this journey is progressing for you.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to talking again.
Excellent. Fred Conjay is also known as Mr. Prairie Fire. He is an adherent to the FIRE movement, Financial Independence, Retire Early. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, credit card do's and don'ts with RateHub's Alyssa Furtado. People in the FIRE movement probably would have lots of don'ts when it comes to credit cards. And later, we'll talk to Smart Savers Luke Connell on RESP plans and other financial options for low-income families. If you have a story idea, a comment, a question, send us a message to askmoolala.ca. That's moolala.ca. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I remember years ago, back in the old days, when I started university, there was this never-ending stream of advertising to get us all to sign up for credit cards. Most of us were pretty new to living on our own and managing our own money, and we were faced with a lot of temptation in those days. Okay, maybe not a lot of temptation, one temptation, and the temptation was beer. There was one major temptation. So in hindsight, perhaps a credit card wasn't the best idea. I don't know. Nevertheless, students are going to have to learn how to manage credit sometime. So today we're going to focus on some do's and don'ts when it comes to credit cards for students. Alyssa Furtado is co-founder and CEO of RateHub.ca. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi. Thanks for having me today.
When did you get your first credit card?
So I think it was after graduating university.
After? You didn't have one during university?
I think so.
Wow.
Maybe I did. But I think that one at least would have been linked to one of my parents' accounts. So,
right.
You know, the first time that I made a decision and had credit attached to my name and didn't have anyone there to bail me out, should I make some bad decisions? Definitely when I graduated.
When you graduated. Well, a lot of people don't wait. And there is so much marketing for people to move very quickly as soon as they hit, I don't know, the age majority or whatever. I want to ask you first, what are things that students should think about in terms of features? We're going to talk about bigger questions in a second, but in terms of features, there's so many things like the rate, rewards, cash back, fees, all that stuff. What are things that students should consider?
So I think one thing is how much balance they feel comfortable taking on. So, you know, it might sound exciting if a bank is willing to give you a credit card with a limit of $3,000.
Right.
But seriously asking yourself, you know, do you need that? And are you responsible enough to handle that? Do you want to kind of work up to that balance after you've paid it off a few times?
People are so funny about the balance. When the bank calls and says, I'm going to raise your balance, people take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
Like, I am so amazing that my new limit is $3,000.
Yes, but then you've got to think that the credit card company is looking at you as a customer and thinking, you know, maybe we want to extend more credit to them and they've shown that they can pay off a balance. Maybe we want to give them more, and they might have some different incentives when extending balance your way. So
limit. What about the reward? Canadians are nuts about rewards. Yes. Should students be nuts about rewards?
I tend to think that you really want to be passionate about rewards when you become a significant spender. So if you're using your credit card very lightly, you might actually be more passionate about lowering your annual fee. So you'd want to look at a low annual fee. But if you are spending a bit of money, you can look for a credit card that will give you rewards back. So I spend quite a bit on the business, for example. And when I first graduated, I was traveling a lot for work. And so I did spend quite a bit. And so rewards became very important for me.
Anything that students should avoid when it comes to choosing that first card?
I think it's just, you know, you want to find the best option for you. So at tools like ours, you can go online, you map out your spending, and we can help you show how many rewards you would get. And then you subtract the annual fee, and you're trying to find that card that gives you the most back in your wallet each year.
I've been surprised how few of the major banks' cards top the list on many of these surveys. What do you find at RateHub in terms of who scores the strongest, in particular for the student demographic?
So one that we really like is the Tangerine Money Back card, and that's because it does have no annual fee, and you can set some of your top spending categories and earn up to 2% back. So to see, you know, on some of your spending categories getting 2% but not paying an annual fee, and there's no income requirement, so that makes it a pretty strong card. It really, you know, it's not a cop-out to say the best card depends on you. We truly believe that. So, you know, if you're someone that's already in debt, for example, we'd want you to look at a balance transfer card where, you know, for a few months you might be able to get zero interest, really focus on paying your debt down, and then transfer to a rewards card if and only if you get out of that debt.
What are the pitfalls on a balance transfer card? Because I am always suspicious about that product.
Okay, so the pitfalls of the balance transfer credit card is if you move your balance over, and let's say you get an introductory 0% interest, but then you go out and spend additionally, let's just say it's $10, and you go to pay $10 on your card, they won't apply that $10 to the high interest rate new spend. They will apply it to the balance that you're paying 0% on. So then you'll start paying top interest rate on your new spending. If that makes sense. So they can be best used if you move your balance over and then put that card almost in your closet for a few months and you want to be spending on a different card.
What's in it for the credit card company to offer that product? Are they just banking on most people using it irresponsibly?
Do you mean specifically a balance transfer?
Yeah.
I think they're banking on getting the balance over and then someone continuing to spend on it. And that new spending is earning and it's being charged at the higher interest rate.
Right.
So that's what they're banking on.
How does a student decide whether they have what it takes to manage a credit card responsibly?
So I think it starts with a small balance to begin with. When I was first starting out, I was pretty disciplined. I'd open up my credit card statement every week, write down in Excel what I spent, and really kind of absorb, oh my goodness, that brunch with that mimosa cost me $50.
You had a mimosa when you were a student? What do you think, Carrie Bradshaw? Jeez.
Basically, yes. I was raised on Sex and the City, and it did terrible things to how I thought my lifestyle should be. But we are taught that, you know, we deserve these things. And the messaging in media, you know, it's not saying, well, you can only afford this if your income's this or your spending's that. So I think it's really about, can you be disciplined enough, open your statement, look every week, pay off your balance 3 times in a row, and then get more comfortable with
it. One of the benefits that people in the industry will say is having a card helps you establish a credit score, which empirically is true. It does help. The offset, though, is that it can get quite risky. What wisdom would you have to a 20-year-old in your life who has said, well, I got to get a credit card because I got to build a credit score? And they chuckle that funny voice.
So if that is their motivation, I would want to remind them that it will only help them build a good credit score if they pay off their balance each month. So again, it's not about having a credit card equals good credit score. It's about using that card responsibly. So kind of that consistent message that it all maps back to, don't get in over your head. A credit card isn't a license to go out and spend $2,000 you don't have. And you really, you know, it's the first steps to spending responsibly. So you want to develop good habits, and it takes time.
Any advice on what people should put on it versus what they shouldn't? Because there are so many, you know, textbooks are an enormous expense. Mm-hmm. Sure, if you spend the $1,000 and put it on your card, you're going to earn rewards or whatever. Mm-hmm. But are there things that you should put on it and that you shouldn't put on it?
So I always say if you're a responsible spender, i.e. you're able to pay your balance each month, then I, for example, like to put all of my expenses on it so I'm not hit with transaction costs on my debit card, and so that everything I'm spending on anyways, I get rewards. Mm-hmm. That looks, again, quite differently. If you're not able to pay your balance off, then you want to keep it to just your essentials, so your phone bills, your utilities, etc., and then maybe you use cash every time you go out to the bar if you can't right. trust yourself at past the hours of midnight,
and you go home.
For example.
You go home. You got no money? You go home. When should a student consider being solely a debit user versus having a credit card as part of the mix?
So if you found historically that you're not able to spend within your means, a debit card can be a really good control check, because your bank is not going to let you spend more than you have. Your credit card will. So if you, you know, need to be out at a restaurant and get that declined funds to really kickstart you and make you change your behavior, then that would be on the debit
And you have
side.
Your excuse at the ready. Oh, it must be some problem with my bank. It's not yes. that I'm in not that I'm in overdraft, because that would never happen to me.
No, never.
Alyssa, thank you very much.
Thanks for having
Appreciate
me.
Appreciate your insight. Alyssa Furtado, co-founder of RateHub.ca, on tips for students when it comes to credit cards. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with author James Fell. But next, we'll look at budgeting on an irregular income with Credit Canada's Laurie Campbell. I'm also the money columnist for Money Sense, an online personal finance magazine. You can check out those segments on MoneySense.ca, then search for me. Or better yet, just read everything, because everybody's great. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Feast or famine, entrepreneurs, freelancers, even students working part-time may all have an irregular income. Budgeting is challenging as it is, but for those people with an irregular income, it can be even more of a daunting task. Laurie Campbell is with Credit Canada. She is here to answer some questions about budgeting on an irregular income and take us through some steps on how to do it right. Hello there.
Hello.
Why is this so much tougher?
Well, you know, it's so much tougher because people, when the money's coming in, they think they're rich, and, yeah. and they think that the money's going to continue to flow. And when it dries up, it's almost like a big shock to them. And they realize that, hey, wait a minute, this is not going to be a continuous stream of cash flow. But then when the money rolls in again, you start feeling like everything's going well. So I think for especially for people who are small business students, when they're in school, for sure, if they get any type of loan at the beginning of the year, all those individuals really struggle to make that money stretch over a period. Of time.
Your first step is to take a look back. And what specifically are people looking at when they go back into their financial archives? What are they trying to figure out?
Well, what they're trying to figure out is what the history of revenue is, you know, income and expense is. So the first thing is to take a look at the income. You know, ideally, if you've been employed for a number of years, if you can go back a couple of years, fantastic. But if you can't, go back as far as you can to find out where the money, it dips and peaks in your financial situation, so that you can make decisions on how to spread that out over time. So the first thing is, yes, take a look back, look at the, you know, what's the history of that cash flow is.
And you probably have a number, an annual number, that would be a pretty important thing to use as your budget for the future. So they say that number is 40 grand or 50 grand or 20 grand, whatever it is, you then would need to think about that in monthly terms so you could match that with like rent and groceries and all that kind of
stuff. Yeah, so if you can do that, if you take a look at your monthly or your annual income and divide it by 12, and then you know how much money you need to put aside for each month, that's great. A lot of people find that difficult. And the reason it's difficult, Bruce, is a lot of people are in a situation where they may have, you know, taxes that are involved and those types of things, and therefore they can't necessarily, you know, backtrack their taxes out of that because they have different types of expenses.
Right. I was when I started in journalism 1,000 years ago, I was one of those people who did not manage the tax thing right and forgot to set aside a sufficient amount and really got burned. Is that one of the bigger pitfalls?
Yes, for sure. It's a big pitfall because then what happens is the tax man comes after you and says, hey, man, you owe us money for the last year. And this is a huge problem with the clients that we see. They come in, they think they thought they were doing really well financially. In fact, they think they come in still thinking they're doing well financially because they have failed to put money away for taxes. They're doing terribly. And actually, in some cases, their business is not even solvent and they don't realize it because they haven't deducted that tax amount.
So step one was take a look back. Step two, create your budget. Given how volatile and how big the swings can be, how do you budget? How do you ensure that you've got, you know, the whatever the amount of your rent or mortgage payment is standing by in the account ready to go?
Well, first of all, when you look at a budget, there are always fixed expenses. Like you mentioned, your rent or your mortgage, those are fixed. So you know no matter what, every month you're going to have to pay that. Put it this way, your bank does not care that you've had a bad month and you're in a bit of a dip. They want their mortgage payment, okay? Your landlord does not care if you haven't got your rent. They want it. So those types of things are fixed. Your utilities are fixed. Other things like going out for dinner, buying clothing are somewhat variable, and therefore they should be the last on the budget. So first of all, you need to figure out what those fixed expenses are, what those ones that you cannot get away without paying are, and then you have to tally those up and figure out what more you have, according to your income, is gravy for all those extras.
Test your budget is step number three. What does that entail?
Well, testing your budget means recognizing that you need to make sure that what you say you have as far as expenses are what you really have. So, you know, take a little budgeting booklet. We offer them at Credit Canada. Track your expenses over a couple of months to find out if in fact what you say you're spending on things is what you're spending on things. You may think your utility bill, let's say your gas bill is only $60 a month, but you know what? You start really looking at that bill over a couple of months, you realize it's much higher than that. And so many people get tripped up because they really don't know where they're spending money. They really don't know what their expenses are. They don't know what their transportation cost is. They don't know what their cell phone cost is because they're just making assumptions. And that can really ruin a budget.
They're deluded optimists like
me.
I was
always a happy thing.
I was at an event last night. And if I were really honest with myself, I certainly had 8 brownies. Like, really, when I think about it, if I was to tell the truth, I think I had 3.
But you know what? They were really small brownies.
And I was only being polite because the host would have wanted me to have. No, I totally gorged my face.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, we do fool ourselves, don't we?
We do absolutely fool ourselves. Step number 4 is create a hill and valley fund. What is a hill and valley fund?
So, you know, this is a brilliant way of looking at your expenses. So in your account, the hills are when you have all the money flowing in. So the hills are there for those times when you're raking in the income, you've got the extra work that's going on, and you're pumping away the money. So those hills you're creating for the valleys. The valleys are when maybe you're a seasonal worker, whatever the case may be, when the times are not so good and you have those lean times, but you can rely on the hills to draw money out during those times of leanness. So the hills are you're putting all that money away, and the valleys are when you're taking that money out to cover the expenses during those lean times when you otherwise hopefully in the past maybe didn't do it as well, but hopefully now you are.
It's kind of like what we all would have had to do a couple of generations ago with our canning and our salting of fish and whatever else we would do to prepare for the winter in which food was not so common.
Exactly. You know, it's so amazing. All those wonderful tools and tips that our grandparents knew, we should really go back to. And that's why, you know, you talk about Moolala, making finances simple. That's what it's all about. Like if you look at our grandparents, what are their famous sayings? Money doesn't grow on trees.
Yep.
Save for a rainy day, and don't buy something until you've got the money in the bank. I mean, those were simple mathematical tools that can serve all of us well today.
What additional insight would you have on credit card usage for someone with a regular income? Because I can imagine it must be so much more complicated to navigate how those bills get paid in this world of hills and valleys.
You know, I think that when it comes to credit, my whole philosophy on credit card use is very simple. No matter who you are, especially those who are self-employed and have a regular income, is that you only use credit for three real purposes. One is safety, one is convenience, and the third is just really taking advantage of maybe some type of cash flow issue if you know the money is coming in the bank very, very soon. So ideally, Bruce, you want to be able to pay off that credit card every month in full. If you cannot do that, or if you think that you're coming into some lean times, don't use that credit card. Because let's face it, the number one reason people use their credit cards is for impulse purchases. So, you know,
I have a distant second. The second reason is to earn points.
Rewards.
I gotta put it on my card so I can earn my points.
I'm not even sure if it's that distant. I mean, people putting the most bizarre things on their credit card they would never, under normal circumstances, purchase because they thought they'd get extra points.
Right. It's like they're trying to hit their steps on their Fitbit. Ooh, I gotta put on my credit card so I can earn the points.
I know. And, you know, you got different types of points now. You can go into a store and it's like 10 times the points today. Yeah. You know, sometimes, so suddenly you buy 10 times the number of things you need. Yeah. It makes no sense. So, you know, I think that we get far too caught up in the impulsive purchasing with credit cards. So I strongly suggest that if you are in lean times, you want to build your credit rating. Sure, I understand that. But use it very frugally. Pay it off every month and make sure those items that you are purchasing are in the budget during the lean times, not during the good times, but during the lean times so that you can actually weather the storms.
Lori Campbell, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Lori Campbell is with Credit Canada. She was here to talk about budgeting on an irregular income. Stay with us. Coming up next, all you need to know about choosing an RESP that's right for you. We'll talk to Smart Savers Luke Connell. And we'll take James Fell through the Moolala questionnaire. If you want to keep up with Moolala on social media, you can follow me on Facebook at Bruce Celery Moolala or Twitter at Bruce Celery. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Most of us understand the importance of post-secondary education and also the challenges that parents and students may face paying for that education. The Canadian government has the Registered Education Savings Plan, or RESP program, in place to help families, you know, save for the long term. But some families might need additional assistance depending on their income level. Luke Connell is the executive director of Smart Saver. He joins us today to talk about the additional financial support that's out there for many Canadian families. Hello there, Luke.
Hi there, Bruce.
Tell us about smartsaver.org.
So Smart Saver is an unbiased resource. And maybe to back it up, Smart Saver is a charity. And what we try to do is connect families to the grants that are available for post-secondary education. And in particular, we focus on low to moderate income families because we find they don't participate in the grants and RESPs the same rate as high income families.
How does funding work? It includes both private and public sector.
Correct. Well, for the RESP itself, you know, that's a parent-owned account, so the parent has to start.
Sorry, I meant for Smart Saver. You have support from the big banks and also from government.
Correct. So we are supported by the five major banks as well as Meridian Credit Union, and we work with a number of large FIs to connect them families with no fee, no contribution RESPs. We also have support through some major private foundations in Canada.
So let's do the basics of the RESP program. It bears repeating. A family contributes a certain amount and there is a government grant. Tell us how that works.
Correct. Well, first off, a parent doesn't have to contribute any money if they can't afford it. And I think the first issue I run into is parents who say, I can't afford an RESP. It's something that's too expensive for me. But really, it doesn't take much to get the account going. Parents can start with as little as, you know, $1. And if you put $1 in, there is an attractive grant structure where you can receive between 20 to 40 cents on every dollar contributed. And on top of that, for low-income families, there is a $2,000 grant called the Canada Learning Bond that requires no contribution to access.
So basically, there is no downside for someone setting up an RESP, because even if they have a low income, they're going to get the Learning Bond, the Canada Learning Bond.
You're right. There's no catch. And we call it free money. And really, I think parents have a hard time understanding what that means, because that doesn't exist.
Right.
But this is one of those rare opportunities where it truly does.
What are the income requirements in order for people to qualify for the Canada Learning Bond? Because the other part, the $500 grant, that you can make a bazillion dollars a year and you still get your $500.
Correct. Anyone who puts money in will receive a match regardless of income. But in terms of the Canada Learning Bond, that's for families who are approximately $47,000 household income or less. And this is retroactive. So, you know, if there's a household where the income is higher now, if there's even one previous year in the past where, let's say, the mom was on mat leave for that year and wasn't earning an income, where that family would still be eligible for a partial installment of that Canada Learning Bond. So there's no reason not to apply.
Your website doesn't provide a lot of details on the scholarship trusts, the Knowledge First and Heritage and those kinds of names. How come?
Good question. Well, I think we focus primarily on modest to low-income households, and group plans, which is what are offered by those scholarship trusts, aren't necessarily the right vehicle for a family who has a variable or low income because they do require mandatory contributions. So we do look at groups like Meridian Credit Union, you know, who is a community-minded sort of member-based organization where there are no fees, or one of the major banks where, again, there's no required contributions as a safe vehicle where there's zero chance of default or loss on the principal put into the account.
It's interesting you say that, because when I think about the scholarship trusts and the marketing that is out there, it really does seem to focus on people who are either new Canadians or lower income.
Well, I think that speaks to what new Canadians are here for, and that's for their kids' future. And a lot of them have sacrificed their own future in order to start saving for their own children. So these companies are very adept at sort of hitting that nerve with the parent in terms of, you know, you want to save for your kids, right? So let's help you do it. And at the same time, I have to say, parents who do go with the group plans, at the end of the day, they'll have a good RESP set up for their kids, but they need to be wary when they sign up.
Provided they follow the rules.
Correct.
Because there are a lot of rules.
There are, and those prospectuses are detailed, and even someone like me who's been doing this for years has a hard time understanding them. So, again, we just say, make sure you know the rules. You know, I typically tell parents, I don't care where you go, just go to your bank. And, you know, that's the place where you're going to get an account that has no fee, no required contribution, and get your grant easily.
One of the other questions that I get asked is, you know, my kid's 10 or 11 or whatever. Is it too late? It is not too late. But tell us about the mechanics of the catch up, because that also isn't that easy. When you want to go back in time and catch up on years that you have missed, it's not that easy.
Correct. And Bruce, what you can do is for every year going forward in the RESP, you can actually make a contribution for one previous year. That being said, you know, starting early takes away that pain of having those big contributions go in. And I will quickly note, too, it's never too late, like you said. And even a small amount of money has a big impact on a kid's expectations on themselves to go. So we see accounts with as little as $3,000 increasing a child's likelihood of going to post-secondary by 4 times and graduating by 6 times.
And that's just because, well, you know, like my parents have been saving so much for education, and even though it's not going to be anywhere near enough to cover the full ticket, that creates some reality that this is what their life plan should be.
Correct. And I have 2 kids, my own RESPs are set up, and I can tell you when they are not doing their homework when they're a bit older, I'll be telling them, hey, look, if there's an account here with like $3,000 or $4,000, you better work hard because I'm working hard to save for your future too.
Right. Do you also threaten to take that money out and spend it on like beer and trips to Vegas?
Every day.
It's like, yeah. I'm spending your money.
Well, that my wife and I talk about it, and it's definitely an item for discussion.
There are a lot of great things on the smartsaver.org website as a resource. Where do you have the conversation about asset allocation? So what I mean by that is the difference between exposure to the stock market versus more conservative things like fixed income. How do you navigate that? Help people navigate that?
That's a great question. And to be honest, we are not a financial advisor, so we don't have a fiduciary relationship with the families we assist. We are creating that warm introduction to their FI, their credit union, where they can then take that conversation and decide what's right for them. And there are mechanisms in place in that onboarding process to make sure that parents are going to get into the investments that's right for them.
Yeah. Luke, thanks for coming in today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Luke Connell is the executive director of Smart Saver. Their site, smartsaver.org. In particular, focus on the Canada Learning Bond. If you know anyone who's a lower income Canadian, you need to point them to this website immediately, because there's so much that you can do to help your kid get a handle on their educational future and provide some savings for them to pursue that. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire, our series of questions about money. Our answerer today is James Fell. He is a writer at Body for Wife. And James, I want the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
I am ready.
How would you describe your money personality?
I would describe it as living well below my means.
Really? And 'twas ever thus, or is this a new thing?
It was not like that until I met the woman who would become my wife. And she was very interested in making good money and living frugally and saving intensely.
What are some things that you do in that regard that might surprise people? Do you, you know, not pay for a furnace and just live in minus 12 degree temperatures in Alberta in the winter? Or what do you do that's kind of like, ooh, I can't believe I do that?
I don't buy trinkets. I don't buy things that I don't need. We bought our first house 21 years ago and then worked hard to pay off the mortgage and then just stayed here. We didn't feel the need to buy a much bigger house. you know, I don't, I could afford a nice fancy car, but I drive a six-year-old Honda Civic now, and our other car is a nine-year-old Toyota minivan. So I don't go out and spend money frivolously, and we just make sure that we're, if we can't afford something, then we don't buy it. We don't go into debt, and we just actively save.
You have an MBA, and you worked for a bunch of years in the traditional business world. Now you're not in that. You're doing your own thing. Why did you decide to make the career switch?
I was very passionate about writing. It was something that I felt was my destiny that I had to do. And I was going to be very upset if I didn't give it a good try. You know, I'd worked in business for about a dozen years. I got the MBA because it seemed like a good way to make money. You know, I worked in business. I made, and I did make good money for a time. And I absolutely took a financial hit in order to pursue this writing career. But I was also, you know, married to a woman that was very understanding and also making good money. And so we just were careful about how we budgeted. And I worked hard to build myself up to where I actually, you know, do quite well as a writer now.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? Knowing that it's all relative, so yours is probably going to be like an apple fritter at Tim Hortons twice a year, and other people will be a Louis Vuitton bag.
I would say that the one thing I don't cheap out on is food. We don't eat out very much. Now, part of the reason, I would say a big part of the reason for that is that I'm very health conscious. And I just know that, you know, when you're eating out at restaurants, that's can be a very significant contributor to weight gain. But the other thing is I like to cook and I work from home. So I have that ability to, you know, plan meals and things like that. But I like to cook fancy meals with fairly expensive ingredients. So I don't cheap out when I go to the grocery store. I buy, you know, more expensive cuts of meat and things like that. So the meals that I prepare for my family are, let's just say we have pretty hefty grocery bills.
Right. What is one financial behavior you'd say you're still working on?
I could spend less money on alcohol, probably, I think, because it's a waste of money, right? There's not much benefit in life to drinking alcohol. And, I think that for me, I think I could actually be making more money rather than spending less. That you know, I just turned 50, and I've been working as a writer for 10 years. Looking back, I think I could have been more aggressive in the way that I approached it, seeing the way other people have done it. But the thing is that the way that I approached my writing career was I wanted to do it in a way where I wrote about what I was really interested in and really passionate about, and just sort of follow my zen so that I didn't get burned out and I didn't hate it. And I look at the way that other people have done it from a much more strategic marketing perspective. And I thought, you know, if I'd done it that way, I absolutely could have made more money doing it that way. But I don't think I would have liked it as much. So as a result, like, my 40s were a blast.
Right.
Great time.
Hey, I want to sneak in one last question. We got under 30 seconds. If you were to think about the parallels between health, which you focus a lot on, and personal finance, which I focus a lot on, what is the number one parallel in terms of getting better at managing your money?
I would say it's all incremental, that I'm part of the get rich slow approach to financial management, and get fit slow is the same type of approach. But you also have to enjoy it. You have to enjoy managing your money and watching your retirement savings grow, just like you have to enjoy watching your health and your body change.
Nice. James, thank you very much for your insight. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Writer James Fell joined us from Calgary, Alberta. Well, that is our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca or to iTunes or Stitcher or any of your podcast providers. You can download the podcast version of this show and listen on the go. You could also write a review or even subscribe to the next episode, so it'll just arrive directly on your device. If you want a little bit of TV instead of radio, I'm the money columnist for CityLine, and most of the work that I do there is on cityline.ca. CityLine's a lifestyle show that airs across North America and has all sorts of amazing guest experts. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a great day.